The mounting challenges we face in society are going to require strength and scale that none of us can achieve on her own. The crises of climate change, inequality, pandemics, and mass involuntary movements of people are already here. And in the United States, each has exposed the poverty of our public capacity to prevent and react. Save for the ultra-wealthy, we're all living at the bottom of the drained pool now. The refusal to share across race has created a society with nothing left for itself. With falling support for government over the past 50 years, has come falling support for taxes, a brain drain from the public sector, and a failure to add to or even steward the infrastructure investments of the early 20th century. We have to refill the pool. Some restoration of public goods will be relatively straightforward, like rebuilding the 50-year-old dams that are failing just in time for climate change to send heavier rains, or laying new pipes to replace the ones leaching toxins into our drinking water. We know how to do that. We've just lost the will. I'll acknowledge a bigger problem with the progressive vision for more robust government. We've let slip our capacity to deliver services with efficiency and skill. The old adage goes that poor people get poor services, and as we've ratcheted down the income level for government benefits over the past 50 years and squeezed public payrolls, the experience of dealing with the government has become increasingly frustrating and negative. Just ask the millions of people who applied for pandemic-related unemployment insurance from state agencies, stripped by years of Republican budget cuts, and who were still waiting months later. The graduates who were unable to get the public service loan forgiveness they'd organized their careers around due to technicalities. Or the voters who navigated a maze of requirements to get a ballot and vote. Refilling the pool will require us to believe in government so much that we hold it to the highest standard of excellence and commit our generation's best and brightest to careers designing public goods instead of photo-sharing apps. When we do, the potential is boundless. The crisis of youth un- and underemployment offers the opportunity to create millions of public service jobs across the country to do the work that desperately needs doing. Every community in America could use the kind of renewable energy project that has engaged the youth in Richmond. From weatherizing buildings to installing solar arrays, the country needs new parks and community centers, childcare and camps to support working parents, literacy programs and home visits to the elderly. We need more internet service in rural and inner city areas, oral histories of gentrifying urban communities and depopulating rural towns, and yes, even new public pools. Public pools were part of the melting pot project that fostered cross-cultural cohesion among white ethnic immigrants and their children in the early 20th century. And it's absurd to think that something as shallow as skin color is an insurmountable obstacle to doing it again. The big and small public works our country needs now should be designed explicitly to foster contact across cultural divides, sending urban youth to rural areas and vice versa, and explicitly building teams that reflect the youth generation's astonishing diversity. An analysis Demos did in the middle of the Great Recession found that $100 billion spent directly hiring people could create 2.6 million public service jobs. Spending the same amount on tax cuts trickles down to just 100,000 jobs. As our country becomes more diverse, there's a way to design our policymaking to get the best out of all our communities and create from the bottom of the social hierarchy an upward spiral of mutual benefit. There is a vanishingly small number of changes tailored for those struggling the most that wouldn't ultimately benefit us all. Policy advocate Angela Glover Blackwell calls this the curb cut effect. After a fix created by people using wheelchairs, that now also helps non-disabled people carrying large loads or pushing strollers. The post-World War II GI Bill is a good example of a well-intentioned policy meant to benefit all veterans that in fact did almost nothing for black veterans for two generations because the policy ignored the disparate conditions they faced, such as being excluded from most of the educational and homeowning opportunities that the GI Bill was supposed to support. There's a better way. It's called targeted universalism, a concept developed by law professor and critical race scholar John A. Powell, who currently directs the Haas Othering and Belonging Institute at the University of California, Berkeley. With targeted universalism, you set a universal policy goal and then develop strategies to achieve the goal that take into account the varied situations of the groups involved. Let's take homeownership, the center of financial security and wealth building for most families, and for the American economy. The building, buying, selling, financing, and consumption of homes contributes to about 15% of the GDP. As we've seen, people of color and Black people in particular have been disproportionately and intentionally excluded from this linchpin of economic freedom. So any program designed to boost home ownership that does not specifically address the barriers facing African Americans can only succeed in increasing the racial home ownership and wealth gap. A public policy that does manage to increase Black home ownership to the same level as white home ownership would shrink the pernicious racial wealth gap by more than 30%. Today, however, our major federal commitment to home ownership comes through the colorblind home mortgage interest deduction, which allows people to deduct from their tax bill interest paid to lenders on all real estate properties they own. The problem is, this massive subsidy is upside down, bestowing the largest benefits on the richest people and effectively rewarding people with wealth for having it, as opposed to helping people without it find a toehold, as the whites-only housing programs did in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. The ability of white families to count on inheritances from previous generations is the biggest contributor to today's massive racial wealth gap. We can do better. The maps have already been drawn through racist redlining, so instead of ignoring them and the damage they wrought, we can target down payment assistance to longtime redline residents, as Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren proposed in the 2020 presidential primary. It's not difficult to imagine the knock-on benefits of increased home ownership among Black people, which range from the financial security and mobility it would provide families to the spillover effects of higher property taxes and therefore education funding. If the United States adopted policy interventions to close the racial disparities in health, education, incarceration, and jobs, the economy would be $8 trillion larger in 2050, the year at which people of color are projected to be the majority. Generic, colorblind plans and policies can never achieve this. A race-conscious housing effort to close the Black-white gap in home ownership could be the centerpiece of a national effort for reparations for the economic harms of slavery, systematic discrimination, wealth suppression, and theft. Given the potential benefits to all of us from racial equity, the imperative for racial reparations becomes more urgent. In their 2020 book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, Professors William A. Darity Jr. and A. Kirsten Mullen make the case that it's the U.S. government that perpetuated the harms and therefore must pay. The book proposes a straightforward process for identifying descendants of African slaves based on census records and genealogy, and models possible payments based on various methods for determining the debt, from the worth of the elusive 40 acres and a mule to their preferred route, closing the current racial wealth gap. Wealth is where history shows up in your wallet, where your financial freedom is determined by compounding interest on decisions made long before you were born. That is why the Black-white wealth gap is growing, despite gains in Black education and earnings, and why the typical Black household only owns $17,600 in assets. Still, having little to no intergenerational wealth and facing massive systemic barriers, descendants of a stolen people have given America the touchtone telephone, the carbon filament in the light bulb, the gas mask, the modern traffic light, blood banks, the gas furnace, open heart surgery, and the mathematics to enable the moon landing. Just imagine the possibilities if, in addition to rebuilding pathways for all aspirants to the American dream, we gave millions more Black Americans the life-changing freedom that a modest amount of wealth affords. A 2020 Citigroup report calculated that, If racial gaps for blacks had been closed 20 years ago, U.S. GDP could have benefited by an estimated $16 trillion. Every day seems to bring more examples of the inverse. What happens when we do not address racial inequality? The 2020 COVID-19 crisis provides a tragically clear example of how failing to design policy with those most impacted in mind will create racist outcomes, ultimately endangering us all. The pandemic saw a colorblind virus attack people with disproportionate ferocity and fatality based on the way that racist and exploitative structures had unequally exposed us to the harm. At the beginning of the pandemic, there was a spirit of unprecedented interconnectedness in the country. When we first understood that in a contagious epidemic, we are all only as safe as our neighbors. The spirit of solidarity and self-sacrifice that blossomed instantaneously from the vast majority of Americans, sewing masks, volunteering to deliver groceries, upending their lives to stop the consumer-driven American way of life and work in order to keep their community safe, was inspiring. But that should not have allowed the people in charge of the pandemic response to neglect the fact that even though we were facing the same storm, we weren't all riding it out in the same boat. In the first months of the pandemic, Black, Latinx, and Indigenous people were multiple times more likely than white people to get sick and to die. The factors were numerous and interlacing. More likely to have to keep leaving home for work, but less likely to have health insurance if they got sick. More likely to be deemed essential, but less likely to be treated so, as employers left low-wage workers in warehouses, care facilities, meatpacking plants, and retail stores without adequate protection. More likely to live in formerly redlined, still segregated areas where pollution degraded their lung quality, in crowded housing, detention centers or jails without social distancing, or on reservations where clean water was hard to come by. A study modeling COVID-19 transmission routes in a representative U.S. city found that the majority of the city's infections came from situations where racism was driving higher exposure. Any serious effort to fight this disease has to treat inequity as a driver of infection and death for everyone, rather than an unfortunate consequence for other people, the study co-authors at the Center for Policing Equity wrote. COVID-19 is telling us, in the starkest possible terms, that the burdens of the most vulnerable, and racism specifically, pose a collective threat. The country was caught without public health capacity largely because of the drained pool, anti-government sentiment that has hobbled the public health infrastructure, and decades of cuts to public hospitals in low-income and of-color communities that left half of low-income areas without a single ICU bed when the pandemic hit. In my hometown of Chicago, according to a ProPublica investigation, leaders cost lives by issuing one-size-fits-all guidance without being attuned to the facts on the ground for Black people. From lower-quality, under-resourced hospitals to transportation inequity, to well-warranted suspicion of the medical system that, combined with the generic message to stay at home, meant that far too many Black people stayed at home until they were already dying. It was people of color who could see the dreadful pandemic's effect in every single one of its manifestations, a clarity born of being maximally vulnerable. This is why it's essential that we listen closely to the experiences and insights of people most exposed to all our society's ills, viral and human-made. It's become fashionable to say, trust Black women, and to root for the leadership of women of color. And maybe it's because I am a woman of color and wasn't comfortable with how self-serving this advice seemed, or because it seemed to suggest a biological basis for some traits. I rejected this shorthand. But the truth isn't that there's some innate magic within us. It's that the social and economic and cultural conditions that have been imposed on people at the base of the social hierarchy have given us the clearest view of the whole system. We can see how it's broken and all those who are broken by it. That's why it's essential that women of color are at least as represented in government as we are in society. as opposed to today, when over two-thirds of officials are white men, even though they're only a third of the population. For nearly two decades in public policy, I saw how the fear of what white people would think held back the ambitions of some of the best policy thinkers in the business. Our politics have operated in the shadow of white disapproval my whole life. We need leaders who see color, who recognize the profound impact social hierarchies have had and continue to have on our national well-being, and who create new visions for how we can recognize our American diversity as the asset that it is. Fox News host Tucker Carlson, who has in recent years chosen to promote a sort of common-sense white nationalism to gain viewers, recently asked on air, "How precisely is diversity our strength? Do you get along better with your neighbors or your coworkers if you can't understand each other or share no common values?" What Carlson did there was a quick elision, from not sharing an ethnicity to not sharing values. In fact, it's just the opposite, I discovered. When people have a chance to create a bond that's not based on skin color or culture, what they actually connect on are the things they value in common. The joking friendship between Nissan workers Melvin and Johnny, built across a racial divide as deep and old as they come in this country, out of the raw material of their commitment to improving life at the plant. How Torm was able to make common cause with black ministers because he knew the refugee community needed to learn from the victories that black activists had won against Chevron in the past. The way that Zam Zam and Bruce connected over their faith and redemption for people in jails and prisons. This is not to say that it was always easy to bridge these divides. Nonetheless, the discomfort of cross-racial connections is actually the source of their power, according to the late Dr. Catherine W. Phillips of Columbia Business School, who was the first black woman to receive tenure there and who became the vice dean. After decades of research, Dr. Phillips made the conclusion that it's the mental friction that creates diversity's productive energy. Members of a homogeneous group rest somewhat assured that they will agree with one another, that they will understand one another's perspectives and beliefs, that they will be able to easily come to a consensus. But when members of a group notice that they are socially different from one another, they change their expectations. They anticipate differences of opinion and perspective. They assume they will need to work harder to come to a consensus. This logic helps to explain both the upside and the downside of social diversity. People work harder in diverse environments, both cognitively and socially. They might not like it, but the hard work can lead to better outcomes. As one example, Phillips described an experiment she conducted to study the impact of racial diversity on small decision-making groups. She and her researchers created three-person teams, half of which were all white and half of which contained one person of color, and tasked the groups with solving a murder mystery. Each participant was given one important clue, known only to them, but otherwise the groups all had the same information. The groups with racial diversity significantly outperformed the groups with no racial diversity, Phillips reported. Being with similar others leads us to think we all hold the same information and share the same perspective. This perspective, which stopped the all-white groups from effectively processing the information, is what hinders creativity and innovation. The power of diversity can help real-life juries find their way to justice as well. One of the professors I visited at Harvard Business School, Samuel Somers, borrowed real jurors from a Michigan court and asked them to reach a verdict in mock trials he conducted. Of the six-person juries Somers organized, some were composed of four white and two black jurors, and some had exclusively white people. The diverse juries deliberated longer and performed better, in part because the white people upped their game in mixed company. White people in the diverse teams cited more case facts, made fewer errors, and were more amenable to discussion of racism when in diverse versus all-white groups. So it turns out that the diversity that is causing an often unconscious racial panic in so many white Americans is actually our biggest strategic asset. The research has borne this out in education, jurisprudence, business, and the economy. Put simply, we need each other. Our differences have the potential to make us stronger, smarter, more creative, and fairer. Once we abandon the false idea of zero-sum competition, the benefits of diversity become evident, from the classroom to the courtroom to the boardroom. Of course, it should be stated that it's quite possible to have a diverse society that still has a strict racial hierarchy. The assumption behind the research on diversity's benefits is that people of different backgrounds are meeting on a plane that is equal enough that they can all contribute, and that they share the will to work together. If that can happen, the benefits multiply. What we'll have to overcome, however, is the gulf that exists between our people's basic factual and moral understandings of who we are as a society. It's a gulf that has been profitable for powerful people in the media and politics, and we can't bridge it if we don't acknowledge the truth of how we got here. The hundreds of conversations I had on my journey convinced me that we can't each do it on our own. We can all buy books and go through trainings in an individualized shopping cart version of racial truth-telling and truth-learning, but that is wholly insufficient to the scale of America's racial story. We need a national effort, rooted in community, one that brings us together and has the full backing of the body that has kept us apart, the U.S. government. A model for such a process began locally in 2017, when 14 communities across the country launched efforts known as Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation, or TRHT. The next year, the Association of American Colleges and Universities did the same, and by 2018, 24 college campuses had TRHT centers. On June 4, 2020, after a week of nationwide protests sparked by the brutal police killing of George Floyd, members of the U.S. House of Representatives, led by Representative Barbara Lee, Democrat of California, introduced a resolution urging the establishment of a U.S. Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Commission. The TRHT framework was developed in 2016 with the input of a group of over 175 experts convened by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. The experts learned from the 40 truth and reconciliation processes across the globe that had helped societies process traumas, from South Africa to Chile to Sri Lanka. But they explicitly left the word reconciliation out of the name for the U.S. effort. To reconcile, notes the TRHT materials, connotes restoration of friendly relations, reuniting or bringing together again after conflict. Whereas the U.S. needs transformation, the nation was conceived on this belief in racial hierarchy. To launch a truth, racial healing, and transformation effort, community leaders must gather a representative group of people, both demographically and in terms of the sectors in the community. The framework involves a process of relationship building and healing by sharing personal stories about race and racism, but it doesn't just help people talk about race. TRHT groups also identify community decisions that have created hierarchy in three areas: law, separation, and the economy. Bridging between the individual stories and the desired policy change is narrative change, accomplished by identifying manifestations of the belief in human hierarchy in our stories, be they school curricula or media portrayals or monuments, and replacing them with complete and accurate stories that honor the full complexity of our humanity as the country forges a more equitable future. The TRHT guidebook lays out instructions for communities, making an idea that can seem lofty and abstract appear manageable but powerful. That's what compelled Jerry Hawkins to give it a shot. Hawkins is a 40-something black man who made a career for himself in Dallas, Texas, as an early childhood educator who cared deeply about the families of the children he taught. Immigrant parents, primarily from Mexico and Central America, he explained to me. But when the TRHT came into his life, he had quit his job in frustration and was about to leave the city. It was the 2016 election summer, and the parents were facing multiple issues of harassment and fear of deportation and reprisal. And so we started to focus on racial equity in that work. And I immediately felt a lot of pushback from folks who were just months ago supporting me doing early childhood work. They didn't want me doing racial equity work, period. They gave me an ultimatum. So he left. But that summer was also the summer when a black veteran killed 5 Dallas police officers and 2 civilians, and civic leaders were calling for racial healing. Community leaders encouraged Jerry to apply for the job of leading the TRHT in Dallas. "I had hesitations around racial healing," Jerry admitted, "because in the aftermath of the Dallas tragedy, it could have pathologized black people. I was really hesitant until I read the guidebook." 3 things in the document changed his mind. One was, and it was so random because I just opened up the page, it was, "Do we need to rewrite the Constitution of the United States?" He laughed a little. Right? So just saying that, period, I was like, wow, this is not what I thought it was. And then I looked at 2 things that I knew I had to do first if I were ever to get this job, and they stuck out to me. A lot of the things in there are really suggestions because they're inviting communities to do the work. But there are 2 things that are very clear, almost mandatory, that you need to do. One was a community racial history, this historical analysis of policy in place, of race, and the people from indigenous times to present. And second was this community visioning process, this way of convening a multiracial, multifaceted group of people together to come up with a shared community vision of how do we end this hierarchy of human value. Jerry was hired, and he's now the executive director of the Dallas TRHT. The multi-year process has solicited the input of hundreds of Dallas residents, civic leaders, business people, police officers, and grassroots organizers, but also high school students and the general public, and community visioning sessions at public libraries across the city. The group published an illustrated report that, when I read it for the first time in 2019, made me gasp more than once. In the opening pages, bold orange words bleed to the edge of a 2-page spread. "Dallas is on stolen land." A few pages later, again, "Dallas was built with stolen labor." For all that I know and have written about these truths, I had never seen them stated so vividly in print in a document that spoke for a city. In our conversation, Jerry called stolen land and stolen labor the first 2 public policies in Dallas. A few pages later, I came upon a black and white photograph of a smiling group of white high school girls in poodle skirts talking to a cowboy hat-wearing Texas Ranger, leaning nonchalantly against a tree. I almost turned the page before I noticed something in the background. At the top of the school building hung a life-size stuffed doll, an effigy of a black man, as a warning against families who had tried to enroll in 1956. A few pages later, a photo of a smiling 12-year-old Mexican-American boy, Santos Rodriguez, whom a police officer shot and killed, Russian roulette style, in the back of a police car, with Rodriguez's 13-year-old brother next to him, in 1973. Toward the end of the book is a present-day photo of a black woman standing in front of what appears to be a mountain, but the caption reads, "Marsha Jackson and the Shingle Mountain," as in a hill created when a plant illegally dumped 70,000 tons of toxic roof shingle material in the backyard of Jackson's neighborhood. The report, A New Community Vision for Dallas, reads like a graphic novel of the racial history of the city in fewer than 50 pages. "It has been an eye-opener for most people," Jerry said, "white, black, and brown, lifelong Dallas residents. 99% of the people who I talk to don't know what happened." There have been some surprises from the Dallas TRHT process. The organization's director of strategy and operations, Erica Y. Flood Moultrie, wanted me to know about a breakthrough moment in one of the community meetings after a presentation by longtime black activist turned city councilwoman Diane Ragsdale. Erica told me how a white suburban school superintendent raised her hand and said, "I want to apologize to you, Miss Ragsdale, because all this time I thought that you were this horrible, mean person who wasn't," Jerry interrupted with the exact word she'd used. "Troublemaker," Erica continued, "that wasn't looking out for the interest of Dallas. I only saw you on TV. And when I saw you on TV, you were agitating. You were, you know, screaming. You were protesting. The media showed you as this bad person." I always, even as a young person, thought of you as a bad person. And I want to apologize to you. Because having this conversation, I understand why it was required for you to protest and what value you bring to Dallas, and that I'm changed because of it. Breakthroughs in the hearts and minds of decision makers in Dallas and the cross-racial relationships that the TRHT process has engendered are great to hear about, but I wanted to know what had changed in the city. Jerry arched his brow. I think the mere presence of TRHT in the city of Dallas, I do want to say this is so different from the coast. We are the only organization in the city focused on racial equity, period. So that's number one. Where if you go to Oakland, there's like, you know, dozens, right? But then Jerry proceeded to list off multiple points of impact. The Dallas School District now has an Office of Racial Equity. The city does too. That's something that the city of Dallas has never had, right? But it has it now, he said with some pride. A conservative city councilwoman, one of the few council people who voted after Charlottesville to not remove Confederate monuments in Dallas, so that's the kind of person I'm talking about, attended a TRHT National Day of Racial Healing event and decided to issue a city proclamation to recognize it officially, which had never happened before. Jerry has joined the Dallas County Historical Commission, so he will have influence over the historical markers in the city. He and his colleagues have trained most of the top city administrators. Jerry taught the students at Southern Methodist University Engineering School about redlining, blockbusting, and why there are such racial divides in the city's built environment, in the hope that they'll know how to plan for infrastructure equity over their careers. After a white policewoman mistakenly walked into Botham Jean's apartment and killed him, the local media began to fall into the trap of denigrating the black victim. But this time, 20 groups organized through the TRHT process sent a letter to the local papers saying that the narratives that are coming out of the Dallas Police Department and the Dallas Morning News were racist. Jerry attributed this swift, coordinated response, which resulted in a meeting with the publisher of the paper, about how the paper could atone for racist narratives and do better in the future, to the emphasis on narrative in the TRHT framework. The demand for what TRHT is doing is outstripping its capacity from all corners of Dallas society, Jerry said with a sigh. There are now folks who are like, I'm a former accountant and I want to do racial equity work. How do I join you all? Truth, racial healing, and transformation was the vision of a woman named Dr. Gail Christopher. She's an expert in public health and social policy, and she's my mother. At the very end of my 3-year journey, I found myself in her home in Prince George's County, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C. We sat in a sunroom in the back of the house that she has transformed over the years into a social justice retreat center. She's a small woman with expressive hands and skin that looks like poured honey, even at 70. Most people who meet her talk about her smile. When she bestows its light on you, you don't soon forget it. She and I were sitting on a cream-colored couch on the day that Congress introduced the resolution calling for a national TRHT. And I asked her why she felt the country needed a truth, racial healing, and transformation effort on top of all the other policies I was advocating for to address inequality. It's a powerful, liberating frame to realize that the fallacy of racial hierarchy is a belief system that we don't have to have. We can replace it with another way of looking at each other as human beings. Then, once you get that opening, you invite people to see a new way forward. You ask questions like, what kind of narrative will your great-grandchildren learn about this country? What is it that will have happened? Truthfully, we've never done that as a country. We've been dealing with the old model, patching it over here, sticking bubblegum over there, she laughed. But we are young. What makes America America is the creative power of our people. It is our responsibility to take this privilege that has come from the exploitation of so many people and the land, to use that freedom to create and actualize the aspirations of tomorrow. We need to envision an America that is no longer bound by that belief in racial hierarchy. We owe it back to the universe. That's bending that moral arc toward justice, she said. And though I'd heard that phrase countless times before, it meant something different to me at the end of my journey. Dr. King said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. But we know that progress is not guaranteed. When the arc in America bends from slavery in the 1860s and returns to convict leasing in the 1880s, when it bends from Jim Crow in the 1960s and returns to mass incarceration in the 1970s, when it bends from indigenous genocide to an epidemic of indigenous suicides, when it bends, but as a tree does in the wind, only to sway back, we have to admit that we have not touched the root. We have not touched the root because the laws we make are expressions of a root belief, and it is time to face our most deep-seated one. The great lie at the root of our nation's founding was a belief in the hierarchy of human value, and we are still there. This moment is challenging us, finally, to settle this question. Who is an American, and what are we to one another? We have to admit that this question is harder for us than in most other countries, because we are the world's most radical experiment in democracy, a nation of ancestral strangers that has to work to find connection even as we grow more diverse every day. But everything depends on the answer to this question. Who is an American and what are we to one another? Politics offers two visions of why all the peoples of the world have met here, one in which we are nothing more than competitors, and another in which perhaps the proximity of so much difference forces us to admit our common humanity. The choice between these two visions has never been starker. To a nation riven with anxiety about who belongs, many in power have made it their overarching goal to sow distrust about the goodness of the other. They are holding on, white-knuckled, to a tiny idea of we the people, denying the beauty of what we are becoming. They're warning that demographic changes are the unmaking of America. What I've seen on my journey is that they're the fulfillment of America. What they say is a threat is, in fact, our country's salvation. For when a nation founded on a belief in racial hierarchy truly rejects that belief, then, and only then, will we have discovered a new world. That is our destiny. To make it manifest, we must challenge ourselves to live our lives in solidarity, across color, origin, and class. We must demand changes to the rules in order to disrupt the very notion that those who have more money are worth more in our democracy and our economy. Since this country's founding, we have not allowed our diversity to be our superpower, and the result is that the United States is not more than the sum of its disparate parts. But it could be. And if it were, all of us would prosper. In short, we must emerge from this crisis in our republic with a new birth of freedom, rooted in the knowledge that we are so much more when the we in We the People is not some of us, but all of us. We are greater than and greater for the sum of us.